You are listening to the podcast of Grace Bible Church Ann Arbor. We are the rescued people of God joining His great restoration project. More information, including sermons in this series, can be found at graceatu.org. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Have you ever seen one of these before? My guess is if you are under the age of 35, maybe you haven't. But if you're over it, maybe you had one of these in your house. This is called a magic eight ball, and it was invented in the 1940s and manufactured and sold as a child's toy. Now, the way this works is that the person who's using it is supposed to ask a yes or no question, shake it up, turn it over, and wait for the answer to be revealed. There are 10 positive answers, 5 negative ones, and 5 sort of non-committal answers. Now, in some of our homes, maybe we grew up where this was considered to be almost evil because it was called a magic eight ball. And perhaps we were taught that people were using some sort of spiritual powers through this toy in order to make their decisions. For others of us, maybe we grew up where we thought of this as just that, just a toy, just a novelty, random sort of thing. Well, regardless, I want you to imagine for just a moment that somebody had one of these and decided, because while decision-making is difficult and life can be really complicated, that they were going to make all of their decisions by using an eight ball. So imagine that you knew somebody like that. They were a friend of yours, that when you would ask them a question, they would first consult the eight ball to determine whether or not, or how rather, they would answer that question. So you're with them one day and you say, "Should we go out tonight to grab something to eat?" Outlook, good, perfect. So you think, "Huh, well, I wonder where we can go tonight." So you ask him, well, "Do you want me to drive to the restaurant?" And you say, and that person with the eight ball says, "Well, will they be safe in their driving?" And they shake it up. It is doubtful. And they say, no, maybe I should drive instead of you." And you go, "Okay, so do you think we should go to the Thai place?" And they shake it up and they say, "Okay, will Thai food sit well in my stomach? Ask again later." Yikes, right? And you know, it goes on and on as they just try to answer all these questions with the eight ball. Well, if you knew somebody like that who was actually making decisions this way, I mean, it might be moderately amusing for like a few minutes, so long as the questions or the decisions that they were trying to consult the eight ball with were relatively small. I mean, if they were to go to the eight ball with a big issue, a big problem, a big question like, "Will you marry me?" And they shake it up and say, "My sources say no." I mean, that would be a huge disaster, right? You wouldn't look at a person who is using something like this for making their life decisions and think, "Oh, that's so funny." No. You would think that person who's consulting something that random, that ridiculous, is a fool. And they're a fool not just because sometimes when they consult it, they make the wrong or a worse decision. I mean, they're a fool for that. But they're a fool because they're basing their entire lives, their entire decision-making on something that is broken, that is a nonsense system. Now, it's hard for us to imagine somebody really entrusting their lives to something this ridiculous. But the truth is, we would love to believe that there is an easy button that could be pushed, the secret sauce out there, the life hack that would allow us to make good decisions all the time, that would help us live right and good lives. We would love to believe that that's the case because we live in an incredibly complex world, and we know that there are all kinds of possible outcomes that can happen in our lives depending on the choices that we make. My wife and I were at a graduation party the other day, and we were talking to one of our neighbors, and she's in her 70s, and she was talking about growing up in Mexico. And as she described her family, and specifically her son, who she spoke about in such glowing terms, she said it was an amazing thing that when he was a young man in college, he was invited by another college student to go to this missions meeting that was happening of these people of faith. And he simply said yes to that invitation. And she said, as a result, That is where he met the woman who would become his wife, this wonderful woman that he's married to. And she said, and now, not only do I have this wonderful son, but now I have this wonderful daughter-in-law and these four grandkids that I just love, and I get to live here in Michigan in this beautiful place. And it is all because he just said yes in that one little moment. Little moments, little decisions, little conversations can have huge consequences in our lives. And so the question is, how do we live in light of that reality? How can we make consistently good decisions? How can we live in a way that will work out in the way that we want it to? There are so many competing voices in our culture and frankly, even in our own heads and hearts, telling us where we should go. So how do we know what we should be listening to? In Plato's Republic, Socrates tells of a ship of fools, which is a group of people that is traveling on this boat along with kind of the wind and waves. It's sort of being pushed along. And all of these people on the boat, all of these fools, if you will, are arguing about who should be in charge and who should have control of the rudder. Now, the reality is there is already a captain on board who does know how to sail. The rest of them are, well, they're fools, and they don't know anything, and yet they keep raising their voices in argument, trying to take control of the ship. Well, Plato and Socrates were using this in the sphere of politics as they were describing that as an allegory, but this idea that each of us has competing voices in our heads, in our hearts, in our culture, trying to demand control of the ship, all while there is a really good captain aboard, is a good picture of reality. We all struggle. Argument, entertainment, information all make a ton of noise, but they aren't necessarily the good captain who can direct us to the good life. So what or who is there that can help us learn to live? Should we just let our feelings steer the ship? Like, should we just trust our guts? Well, maybe sometimes. Like, there have been times I've trusted my feelings, trusted my gut, and it's worked out great, but not all the time. So should we trust our friends? Like, whatever the people are that are around us, we should just listen to their advice and do what they tell us to do. Well, hopefully you have great friends around you, so sometimes that's a good strategy for making decisions and living your life. But we all know that feelings and friends and magic eight balls can fail us in that regard. So how can we then learn to live? This question of making good choices, good decisions, of living right has been around since, well, the beginning of time. The very first couple that we meet in the biblical narrative, they're faced with a choice. And would it be a choice that they made to really follow God or not? Don't count on it. Despite the fact that they had been given every opportunity to walk a path with God and to embrace a flourishing, obedient, godly, wonderful life, they chose instead to rebel, to embrace foolishness, sin, and ultimately even death. And yet, the whole time, there had been a captain, a tutor, a mentor, if you will, who was there, who could have helped them choose better, make a better decision, and embrace the true life of partnering with God in His great story. So today, we're beginning to talk about what it looks like to learn to live. And to help us a little bit, we're going to settle into the book of Proverbs just for a bit. Now, if you're a Bible nerd, maybe you hear the book of Proverbs and you think, is that really a book worth spending a lot of time studying? Because, you know, I've heard of some of the Proverbs. They're like these like little one-liners. Like here are a couple that maybe you've heard. Gray hair is a crown of splendor. It is attained by a righteous life. Now, that is certainly a proverb that I like a little bit more as each year goes by. Or maybe you've heard this proverb. If a man loudly blesses his neighbor early in the morning, it will be taken as a curse. Well, in other words, if you're a morning person, tone it down a little bit for the rest of us. Or maybe you've heard this one. This is always a favorite. It is better to live in a corner of the housetop than in the house shared with a quarrelsome wife. I think we can figure out what that one means, right? But maybe that's all we know about the Proverbs, is these punchy little one-liners that we kind of like, and it sounds sort of clever. And yet there is so much more to the book than these three little gems. So we are going to start today with the first seven verses of Proverbs, and then we're going to kind of work through more of this in the weeks to come. But here's what it says in Proverbs chapter 1, starting in verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance, to understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. Essentially, this entire book was written, compiled to be sort of a study guide for groups of people to use to try to learn how to live, try to learn how to make better decisions and to pass the tests of life. Communities, families were like study groups who would gather around with these words and they would wrestle through them so that they could really know the way that God wanted them to live. So today we're going to tackle this section in four parts. The introduction to the Proverbs, the problem of the Proverbs, the beginning of wisdom, and the person of wisdom. So part one is the introduction to the Proverbs. The book of Proverbs as a whole is actually made up of some different sections. It's not all just a bunch of punchy little one-liners like those ones that we read before. In fact, there are multiple sections within the larger book. It was all written or compiled, we think, by a man by the name of Solomon. Now, much of it is attributed directly to Solomon, but there are some sections in it that are called the sayings of the wise. So it looks like those are sayings that were collected and sort of compiled by Solomon. The first chunk of Proverbs is written a bit like poetry. It contains a number of speeches from a father to his son about what it looks like to pursue wisdom as opposed to foolishness. And in that first chunk, there's this really strange chapter in chapter 8 where wisdom almost talks as if it's a person. Like it kind of takes on its own voice and begins to give this speech about how people ought to seek out wisdom, saying that wherever people are making wise decisions and living well in God's creation, that they are doing so by wisdom. That's sort of the first chunk of the book. The middle chunk of the book is where you find those punchy one-liners. There are something like 375 Proverbs, many of which are attributed to Solomon, and some which are under the heading of sayings to the wise. And then the last section was written by two guys that we don't know much about them, named Agur and Lemuel, who write some longer sections as well. Now, what is a proverb? Because the book says the Proverbs of Solomon. So what's a proverb? Well, a proverb in Hebrew is related to the word to represent or to be like. A proverb is a little model of reality. In other words, a proverb is something that we look at, and when we begin to understand it, we start to realize how life works. It's almost like a flight simulator, that when you learn how to operate a flight simulator, you can kind of see what it's like to fly in real life. Well, that's what a proverb is. Well, what are these proverbs supposed to do? Well, it tells us right at the beginning what it is. The Proverbs of Solomon, who's son of King David of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction. So these proverbs were intended to help people grow in wisdom, which of course brings us to our Bible nerd moment of the day. Bible nerd moment of the day. Now, by popular demand, we brought back the little goofy jingle thing that we're inserting here. If you hate it, I'm so sorry, but we just thought it would be fun to bring it back. But our Bible nerd moment of the day is to really dive into this word, wisdom. The Hebrew word for wisdom is chokmah. Chokmah. Now, if you want to have fun, turn to someone near you and say chokmah. And then wipe the spit off of their face after you said chokmah. Now, what is chokmah? Well, we are told that wisdom comes from the Lord. But what is it? Throughout these verses, Solomon wants us to gain insight, which is kind of this deep understanding of how things work. He wants us to learn to deal with other people with righteousness. He wants us to be just and equitable. He wants us to make better decisions. But what exactly is chokmah or wisdom? Well, there's this pastor, scholar, YouTuber guy called Aussie Dave. And he actually does a great little video on this word chokmah, where he talks about what it means. And he said, you know, many of us think of wisdom as being some sort of information or insight that only some great scholar, like a university professor or a rabbi or a pastor, somebody who's really spent years and years and years studying can have, that it's chokmah is only for them. But in the Bible, that's not necessarily the case. While chokmah does refer to folks with great biblical knowledge, like rabbi or pastor, biblical professor, it also refers to skilled craftsmen, laborers, artisans, accountants. It really refers to anybody who has learned how to do their craft with some great skill. Chokmah is learning how to be successful in daily life. It's learning to live. And that is why in their culture, being older carried much more cachet than being younger. Because an older person clearly has navigated some challenges in life. They have learned some secrets to getting to that stage of their lives. And so in that culture, they were considered to be, more somebody that you'd want to emulate more because they had more of this chokmah. It's like if I see some older person who has battled through various health issues, let's say, and yet they have worked extremely hard to be consistent and thoughtful and mindful and taking care of their body, I am more impressed by the 70-year-old who's still hiking and the 80-year-old who's still mowing their lawn and the 90-year-old who's golfing than I am by the ripped 20-year-old bro who's taking pictures of his abs on Instagram, right? Because it's like, who cares? These people have demonstrated that they've learned something over the course of their lives when they're in their 70s and their 80s and their 90s, and they're still working at it. Dad bods for the dub. Am I right? No, I'm just playing. But my definition of biblical wisdom combines a few elements, this chokmah. It combines three things. One part is understanding. Understanding is the what and the why of something. It also has insight involved in it. And insight is the how and the when of something. And then lastly, there's resolve, which is the doing of the thing. So chokmah is understanding, it's insight, and it's resolve. That's what wisdom is. Now, maybe this is a silly illustration, but mowing the lawn is, it's not actually all that intuitive. What I mean is, you know, some of us have mowed hundreds of times. So we're just like, oh, it just makes sense. But, you know, as I've tried to teach my kids how to do it, I have to remember that it's not just obvious how to operate this machinery or to know what type of fuel to put in it or even to know when to mow their grass. Like here in Ann Arbor, apparently you're not supposed to mow your grass in May because it could kill some bees or something. Don't worry, no bees were injured or harmed in the making of the sermon illustration. But it's not necessarily intuitive to know how to do it and when to do it. And it certainly isn't necessarily something that if you're younger, you're like, oh, I really have the resolve to do it. It actually takes chokmah to know how to how to mow properly at the right times in the right ways to get out there and do it. And so it requires understanding, insight, and resolve to be truly wisdom. And this wisdom can help us in every arena of life. That's why ancient Jewish folks spent so much time studying the Proverbs, because they knew that if they wanted to be good as an accountant, as a parent, as a human being, they would need to have the right mix of these things, of understanding and insight and resolve. Because if they only had a couple of these or one or two of these things, then they were going to struggle. I mean, imagine an incredibly understanding person who listens to everybody's sob story all the time. But they don't have real insights as to the best sort of way to be helpful to somebody. they might, despite the fact that they're incredibly compassionate and understanding, do more harm than good if they don't have all of these things together. Or think about the person who maybe is really resolved, right? They're just always making quick decisions. But they lack understanding. And so they make bold decisions, but they don't take into account the complexity that is existent in the real world with real people. Well, they might wound people even though they're really resolved. Or think about the person who has incredible insights into lots of things, and they always seem to kind of get, oh, here's when we should do this and how to do this, but they lack resolve to ever follow through. So you need all three of these things to have this skill, this way of learning to live. Chokmah is wisdom that happens when all three of these things are put together. It is learning the art of living. And this book of Proverbs sets out to help us learn this. But there's a problem with the Proverbs. So that was the introduction, and this is part two, the problem of the Proverbs, part two. What does it say in verse 5? Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance. To understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. Well, as you look at these verses, you start to see that there's like a little bit of an issue here. I mean, it uses words like riddles. And a riddle doesn't always have obvious answers. We said that wisdom is like learning to live, but it's learning the art of living, right? What we find is that living is kind of a science, but also kind of an art. That there are patterns and rules for life, but there are also exceptions. Let's go back to that flight simulator idea. You can learn a lot of things in a flight simulator, and I'm sure it has all kinds of ways of throwing different things at the potential pilot so that they learn what real life is like. But then you still get into real life, and maybe the co-pilot is having a bad day or has a health issue. Maybe a passenger is being belligerent. Like, for as much as you learned in that little model, it may or may not pertain exactly like that in real life. And that is, in fact, the problem of the Proverbs. These Proverbs present a model, but things don't always work out like that 100% of the time. When we read the Proverbs as if they are promises, then what happens is we get frustrated when we do what the Proverbs say and then life doesn't work out like that. No, no, no. A proverb is presenting this model of reality that shares with us what the patterns are like in this world, but sometimes things don't fit the pattern. And so as people were gathering around these proverbs, they were also looking at books like Job and Ecclesiastes, which talk more about the exceptions to the rules. We'll be in the Proverbs talking more about the patterns, but if we only look at the Proverbs, it can be problematic if we don't recognize that at times, not everything fits the pattern. As we study Proverbs, my guess is if you are somebody who's more conservative in nature, maybe a little bit older, you might resonate strongly with the patterns that we see in here. You might think, man, I've seen these kinds of things play out time and time again. It is just math. That's just how it works. Like, if you quit your job before you have another job, well, then bad things are going to happen. If you don't work hard, bad things are going to happen. If you do study hard, then you will succeed. And maybe you have that personality where you just sort of see how things seem to work well for those people that fall in line with the pattern. But the challenge is, if you're more conservative, or maybe if you're a little bit older and you have this sort of leaning in your thinking, is that sometimes real life doesn't fit. And so you might become insensitive to the exceptions to the rules or to the fact that life can be extremely hard. And even when people do the right things, sometimes there aren't great results. For those of us who are maybe a little bit more on the progressive side of things by nature, or maybe we're a little bit younger or something, maybe we find ourselves defaulting more to the exceptions to the rule, the plasticity, like the real life hard stuff, rather than these overarching patterns. And maybe you have seen time and again with your friends or people that you know how health issues can arise, accidents can happen, emotions and relationships are complicated. Real life isn't always math. People and decisions aren't as simple as formulas. And so it can be easy for some of us who are maybe in that category to lose a little bit of our resolve when it comes to trying to stick ourselves into these patterns when we know how difficult life is and how easy it is for exceptions to the rules to happen. And so you can actually find, this isn't just a like a political thing or an age thing, you can find these patterns in families. I mean, in lots of families, you'll find one kid who is all structure and formality and grind, and then you'll find one who's all flexibility and friendship and emotion, all in the same family. This is just how we are wired, but we must be sure that we don't simply become really conservative fools or really progressive fools, but that we dedicate ourselves to understand the fuller counsel of God's chokmah, his wisdom for us. And so, as we're looking at this, we need to be understanding what the Proverbs is, intro to the Proverbs and what wisdom is. But we also have to recognize if we just take this and we only see patterns or we only see exceptions, there can be a problem here. And so this brings us to part three. Part three, the beginning of wisdom. So if we do then want to grow in chokmah, wisdom, if we want to learn the art of living, if you will, where does it begin? Well, I want to do something with you that we did last week, which is direct you to a verse or two in the book of Proverbs where I've left some blanks. Because if I were to tell you this is the beginning of wisdom, we might have preconceived ideas about how we would fill in that blank. Like in Proverbs 1:7, what is the beginning of knowledge when fools despise wisdom and instruction? Or in Proverbs 9:10, what is the beginning of wisdom and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding? So without any biblical prompting, what do you think some options would be for beginning to really know wisdom? I mean, if somebody were really dedicated to growing wiser, where should they start? Should they start with Google, right? It's information. But if we're going to get more understanding, we need more information. And so we should start by really like just working to increase in our intelligence. Is that the beginning of wisdom? Or maybe experience. Maybe the beginning of wisdom is get out there and live life, right? You only live life once type thing. And I'm just going to go experience everything and that will make me wise. Is that what Solomon tells us is the beginning of wisdom? Or maybe it's discipline. If I want to be a wiser person, the way I start this is to really just knuckle down and just try and grunt, and I'm just going to discipline myself. And that is the beginning of wisdom. Is it? What does he say? What is King Solomon, the man widely regarded as the wisest man who's ever lived, what does he say is the beginning of wisdom or knowing wisdom? Well, this is what it says in Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Proverbs 9:10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So the beginning of knowing wisdom is the fear of the Lord. Now, what is the fear of the Lord? The kind of fear that Solomon is talking about here is not simply being afraid of an enemy or being concerned about some unpredictable thing that might harm us, some danger out there. To be sure, anybody who ignores God is essentially making God an enemy, and they ought to be afraid because he is all-powerful and never wrong. And he's not just going to allow sin and injustices to continue. So yeah, in a sense, anybody who's ignoring God ought to be afraid. But the fear of the Lord here is not being said by somebody who's ignoring God. It's being talked about by somebody who knows God well. So then what is this fear of the Lord? Well, the fear of the Lord in Proverbs 1 is the converted person's reverent love and commitment to God that rightly understands his power and grace. It is a converted person's reverent love and commitment to God that rightly understands his power and grace. I have no idea where I stole that definition from, but I really like it. The fear of the Lord being talked about here is the fear that somebody has when they know God, but they don't have like just simple terror, but rather deep respect and trust that longs to please God. Think about a puppy, because why not? Everybody loves to think about puppies, but a puppy must learn the right kind of fear. We have in our home a big, blocky, yellow lab who, as a puppy, was insanely cute, which was a very good thing, because his cuteness is the only reason he survived, because he was also incredibly evil for a long, long time. And he needed to learn a kind of fear. When he would grab something that he shouldn't have, he knew it. But he would grab it, and then he would play a game where he'd get real low, and he'd get his backside and his tail up in the air, and he'd prance around, and he'd show it off, and he'd try to yell at him and be stern, and he would just run and try to get away from us. And eventually, we'd have to try to catch him and correct him. Now, for a long time, my children, they were very young at the time, they couldn't get him to obey in any way. Now me, maybe because I was a little bigger than they, my voice is a little deeper than theirs, when I would yell at him, he would get kind of this immediate sort of, uh-oh. And so it didn't take long for him to learn to fear me, where I would just go, hey, drop it. He would stop, and he would drop it. Now, that was kind of a good version of fear. He wasn't afraid of me in the sense that he knew that I would feed him, I would care for him, I would play with him. I love this stinking dog, right? He wasn't afraid of me in that sense, but he was concerned about disobeying me. Well, there's this one morning where he decided to run into the neighbor's yard despite the fact that I kept calling him. And their two adult dogs were out there, and he went full on puppy mode with them. And he was a little bit like that annoying morning person that we read about in the Proverbs earlier, and they didn't take too kindly to it. Now, they're not mean dogs necessarily, but in this particular case, they let him know their displeasure, one of which kind of chomped him a little bit. And when that happened, all of this sort of silly, I'm gonna be like, oh, I'd be this crazy little puppy, it was gone and it was replaced by terror. And he sprinted back to our yard. Now, I was standing in the yard yelling to him, come, 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 whatever. Where do you think he went in his fear? Well, he had a fear of me, right? But it was different than the fear he had of those dogs. So in that moment, his fear didn't lead him to run away from me. It led him to run right to me and to hide and to cower under my legs. Why? Well, because although in some senses I am dangerous to disobey, I'm also the one who would keep him safe and care for him. And that's what Solomon is talking about here. There is a healthy fear that we should have of God. We should beware of disobeying him, knowing, again, that he's all-powerful and he's never wrong. But we should also have such a tremendous amount of trust in him, in his power, in his goodness, that all of that power of God is for us. He's not some unpredictable danger. He's actually a good and loving father. C.S. Lewis in The Problem of Pain said it like this. God's love is not a senile benevolence that drowsily wishes you to be happy in your own way, nor the cold philanthropy of a conscientious magistrate, nor the care of a host who feels responsible for the comfort of his guests. Instead, it is the consuming fire himself, the love that made the worlds, persistent as the artist's love for his work, as despotic as a man's love for a dog, provident and venerable as a father's love for a child. There's this great scene in the movie The Fellowship of the Rings where Gandalf the Grey is trying to convince Bilbo that he needs to kind of give up and leave behind his ring for Frodo and needs to go on this journey that he's planned. And Bilbo had agreed to that before, but in this last moment, Bilbo is having trouble actually taking the ring and putting it in an envelope and leaving it behind. And so Gandalf, up until this point, has seemed incredibly benevolent. He has created this fantastical, beautiful fireworks display, much to the delight of the Shire's children. He has given some sagely, wizardly advice. I mean, he's just like this great character in the book. But in this moment of resistance, Bilbo, even though he had listened to Gandalf up until this point, starts to resist, and he even starts to accuse Gandalf of maybe wanting the ring for himself because he's got this kind of evil hold over him with this ring. And as he begins to turn on Gandalf, all of a sudden Gandalf's fury flashes It's as if the world darkens a little bit and all the focus goes on Gandalf, where he looks and says, "Bilbo Baggins, do not take me for a conjurer of cheap tricks," in this kind of booming voice. And in that moment, Bilbo realizes, oh, the power of this Gandalf is wonderful to behold, but as an enemy of Gandalf, it is terrible. That is the fear of the Lord. Wisdom begins with knowing that there is a God in heaven who has created all that we see, including us. But he is no senile grandfather or indifferent despot or some sagely wizard. He is the very creator of the universe, the one who has made the world and all that is in it. It is he who meets our daily needs. It is he who gives us breath in our lungs. It is he who has woven together the patterns of this world and created order. It is he who has numbered our days. It is he who can give us understanding, insight, and resolve. Wisdom is a gift, but it only comes when we start with recognizing who God is and fearing the Lord. We live in an age where people seem to believe that they can make all of their own rules. They don't need to learn how to live. They're just going to live. They're just going to do them, I guess. They just think that whatever they feel, or whatever their friends, or just whatever's authentically them, they can go ahead and just do it. I just finished reading this book called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Cultural Amnesia, Expressive Individualism, and the Road to Sexual Freedom. Whew, that's quite the title, isn't it? But in this book, essentially what the author talks about is at some point along the way, we have moved from living in a world where there was an assumption that there was some sort of authority and God out there who could tell us how to live and what to do, to now living in a world where the assumption is the only one that can say how I ought to live is me. I get to express whatever I want. This is all about me. There are no patterns. There are no rules. There are no standards. There is no authority that can guide my life, whether it's a leader or a pastor or a boss or a teacher or a parent or even my own body. Nothing can tell me how I ought to live. I get to tell me how to live. Well, if that's the case, if that's the way we're going to try to live, we will be fools. It's not until we begin to recognize who God is and who we are in relationship to him that we can begin to move in this pathway of wisdom. There's a great God. There is a captain. But it ain't us. We will only begin to understand the art of living when we start here with the fear of the Lord. Which brings us to part four, the person of wisdom. Some of you have heard these sorts of things before about there being a God in control of your life and that you need to turn over the helm, the rudder, the steering wheel, whatever it is, of your life to this God as captain. And while that might sound good to you, in theory, maybe, there might be some of you who are listening who think, you know what, my life is sailing along great. Like, I don't think I need to turn over this. I mean, I guess I would turn my life over to God or whatever if there was some perfect argument for why I really even need this God. But in the meantime, it seems like things are going pretty well for me. And so we kind of try to keep our hands on the helm ourselves. There might be others of us who have yet to turn over our lives to this captain. Well, because, well, our lives have been a disaster. And we kind of feel like, wait, if he has been at the helm of my life, it has been such a mess. How can I know that he's trustworthy? Like, if there's some perfect argument for why I could trust in this God, then maybe I would sort of turn over to this captain. And so if that's you, if you're somebody who said, you know what, I've never really sort of just turned over my life in faith, this fear of the Lord thing, I'm not really sure I'm there because I haven't heard a good enough argument for it yet. If that's you, I want you to consider something today, maybe for the first time. I mentioned earlier that there's this weird thing that happens in Proverbs chapter 8. In Proverbs chapter 8, wisdom begins to talk as if it's a person. It's really kind of this cool literary device, right? Where wisdom is sort of like embodied and it begins speaking to everybody and saying, seek me, live by me. I am the way you can learn to live. So here's what I want you to consider.
What if instead of God sending a perfect argument about why he should be feared and revered and trusted and loved? What if instead of sending a perfect argument for why you need him, what if he sent instead a person who was himself kind of the argument?
What if God sent us someone who might live among us and demonstrate God's love for us?
And might demonstrate what it looks like to walk in wisdom. That's exactly what God did. He sent the person of wisdom. He sent his son Jesus to demonstrate that we can trust him because he loves us that much, even in those bumps and those bruises and those hard moments.
He sent us Jesus, who could show us just how much we need him to rescue us from ourselves, from sin and death. He sent himself as a person that we must trust in order to begin to live with wisdom. God sent not an argument, but himself. Jesus is the wisdom of God for you.
And it is only when we bend our knee to Jesus, which looks like foolishness to the world, that we begin to live right, to make the most important choice in the best possible way. It is only when we embrace the foolishness of the cross that we begin to truly live. In some ways, Jesus is just like a lot of other sages who have lived. Right? When you look at his teachings, you go, oh, wow, that sounds like, you know, Socrates or Plato or whoever we talked about earlier, right? Like, he might look a little bit like that. But there's a pretty big difference. Because not only did Jesus speak the greatest words ever spoken, he lived the perfectly wise life, and then he laid down that very life for you so that you could walk with this tutor of wisdom speaking to you. And that you could live the flourishing life. Jesus is the wisdom of God with us, and he can reshape us for royalty as God goes to work on each and every one of us.